This is Talking Business. Joining me now is Michael Smith, owner of the Sun Cinema in Yarraville and flyer of small planes around the world.
Hi, Alan. Good morning.
Hey, Michael. Now, I'd like to just start with Sun, the cinema there, because obviously what you're on about recently is, you know, the adventure you've undertaken and written about and done a film about. But when did you buy the Sun Cinema and what made you do it?
Look, we bought it back in 1995, my wife and I, and the business we were in at the time was manufacturing, a very niche business. It was manufacturing equipment for cinemas. So we made cinema screens and we had agencies for projectors and sound systems, and we made things like the curtains.
I didn't know we had a business like that in Australia.
There we go. There was and back in the mid-90s...
That was just a family business?
It was a family business, but back in the mid-90s, it was a business that almost no one was in. And we ended up working in 30 countries around the world. You know, we ended up with a bunch of staff, an office in Singapore and London, and we were running all over the place doing these jobs. So that business was, kind of...
Obviously quite successful.
Quite successful and very exciting. At the time, we were in a warehouse in Brunswick that we were really quickly outgrowing. And I mean, I was 25 years old. I was living in a room in the warehouse. It was all very seat of the pants. But we needed a bigger building, and I thought, wouldn't it be great to find one of those old cinemas? And I looked around, and most of them had become carpet warehouses or something else. But we found this one in Yarraville, and it had been empty for 20 years. And literally, I crawled in through a hole in the back wall and just saw this amazing space. And
it was because it was one cinema, right?
That's right.
Held 1,000 people.
1,000 people. So what we did was we actually gutted the cinema. It was wrecked anyway. It had white ants. And so we gutted out the floor and we poured a concrete slab and we turned it into our warehouse and our offices. And we worked out of it for years. But as the years went on, we restored the building bit by bit, and and people started knocking on the door saying, "What's showing?" And I'd run the film club at Melbourne Uni, so I thought, "Well, I love showing films. Let's set up the upstairs area as a bit of a cinema." And we started showing films once a week, and then it started once a weekend. And the next thing we knew, we were relocating the manufacturing business, and we opened it as a multi-screen cinema.
Oh, so you didn't sell the manufacturing business?
We did in the end. Yeah, A year after the Sun opened, I had some tough decisions to make. Things got a little bit tight and our cash flow was struggling. So we sold the manufacturing business and then really focused on running the Sun.
So you've got 8 cinemas there now, haven't you? Yeah, and some of them have just got couches in them.
Well, they've all got leather seats now, but half of them are little 40, 50-seat leather couch cinemas.
And so is that a good business? Does it work?
It is today. It's amazing how many times I've found myself at a dinner where there's, lots of guys from the upper end of the business world, and when they say, "What do you do?" and you say, "Oh, I'm in cinema," and they go, "Oh, how's that going?" And it's like, well, actually, at our end of town, it's going really well. We, it is again a niche business, and I think that's one of the things I've really learned as an SME operator that, we're better to occupy the niche. For many years, I thought I want to be bigger and bigger, and I have maybe even delusions of grandeur of how big you can make the business, but eventually you realize that, if you've got limited resources, the thing to do is really focus on doing something small really, really well. And I think that's what we've done at Yarraville. We were the first cinema to get a liquor license for the whole building. So not only are sitting on a leather chair, but you can take in a bottle of wine and every film's better with a glass of red wine.
Couldn't agree more. So you're going along, everything's fine, and you decide to fly a small plane to London.
Yeah, look, I was really – so the Sun Theatre opened in 1938 and I was researching – we had the 75th anniversary of the cinema coming up, and I was thinking, what else happened in 1938 that we can draw some parallels between with the Sun Theatre? And it turns out –
Oh, is that how it came up?
That's how it came up. And
right.
It turns out that's the first year that Qantas flew from Rose Bay through to London, and it was revolutionary because it only took 10 days to get there by plane instead of 6 weeks by sea. And what actually drove that plane service wasn't the need for people to get to London. It was the need for communication. And it was, when we think in this world of email we're in today, it took them from the average return time on a letter was 3 months by the time you could send a letter and get a response back down to, 10 days there and 10 days back. So it had a major effect. And it was called the Empire Airmail Scheme that funded that plane. So I thought that was pretty romantic, and I love the idea that, they used to stop every night. They'd stay in hotels like Raffles. So I had this idea for years that wouldn't it be great to retrace that route? And I had a small, I'd been flying seaplanes, and I thought, well, you know, those planes don't exist anymore. I'll go and do it myself.
And so how much planning had to go into that trip? Because you would have had to figure out where you were refueling each time.
It was a great logistic, you know, luckily I enjoy logistics. It was a great logistical exercise. There was, where can you find fuel? I had to get permission to land in the airspace of every country. I had to get permission to then land at the airports.
Do you have to get permission to land on rivers and
some countries,
lakes?
Yes, and others you don't.
Because you have a seaplane, as you
say. So that's the thing, it's an amphibian. So the beauty of this plane is you can land at a big runway and then you can land on a lake or river. So because the original Qantas planes only landed on water, I was trying to land where they did, but a lot of countries, like India, it's just not permitted to land on the water. But, you know, by contrast, in Dubai, I had to land at Dubai International Airport amongst all of the Airbuses to clear customs and immigration. But then the next day, they let me go and land on Dubai Creek, which is the original runway that Qantas landed on back in 1938. So that was pretty bizarre.
But when you decided to do that, did you realise it was going to turn into a new career for you?
No, not at all. And
because it kind of has, hasn't it?
Look, it has. It's become, I'm kind of spending half my time at the cinema and now half my time talking about the trip and the lessons from the trip. And, you know, it's a lot more than just, you know, the trip itself, because I've seen all these parallels between planning for the trip and what we do in business. But it's also because I didn't plan to go around the world. I just was working on getting to London, which I thought would take me 8 weeks. And so from a work point of view, I told my staff I'd be away for 2 months, and, you know, that wasn't such a stretch for them to deal with me being away. Once I got to London, my wife came and met me, and, you know, I was planning to ship the plane home, but she really encouraged me and said, look, since I've known you, you've been talking about sailing around the world one day. The plane's kind of a boat. Why don't you just keep going? And, you know, once you get that tick from home, it's kind of pretty easy to get on with the rest.
So, but how did you get across the Atlantic?
I had to fly up to Scotland, to Iceland, Greenland, and then across to Canada before going down to New York. I didn't have the range to go nonstop.
And in fact, as I understand it, the hairiest moment was coming into Canada from what, Greenland?
It was. It was at the end of an 8-hour leg, and I unfortunately got lost in some cloud, and it was really scary. I came very, very close to not making it home.
Yep.
Yeah, and we might just leave that at that. But it was scary, and I must say it's been a real moment of awakening. I mean, when I landed that day, I was very close to throwing the whole thing in, but I thought about it for a while, and I thought, no, look, if I don't get back on, I'm never going to do this again, and I kept going. But I do realise how close I came to not making it home. So,
and island hopping across the Pacific was okay, was it?
It was okay, but it was really daunting. It was logistically very hard. You know, I'll give you one quick story, which I think is, again, another great example of just sometimes you paint yourself into a corner and have to work out logistically how to get out of it. I was the last island in the Aleutian Islands, which is part of Alaska, is Adak. 100 people live there. I was sitting there trying to get – I was waiting for permission to fly into Russia after 3 weeks.
Oh, you went across the Bering Straits?
I went, yeah.
Okay,
And permission never came to get into Russia. And so I had a choice. I could actually either finish the trip, or I'd worked out that on the way to Japan, it would take me 23 hours to fly from here to Japan, but I could only fit 21 hours of fuel in the plane. It had been heavily modified, but I couldn't make it. But there was an uninhabited island on the way, and I worked out that if I flew out 6 hours and I ferried fuel and left it on the side of an abandoned Cold War runway and then flew back to the other island, topped up my fuel again, and then flew back again, topped up that fuel that I'd left on the island, I could then fly 18 hours to Japan. So it turned into this mammoth 20 hours of flying in one day, crossing the date line and flying 14 hours in the dark. And it was a very hairy trip. I kept falling asleep in the middle of the night. I didn't have an autopilot, so falling asleep is a major issue.
Of course it is, dear.
It was really scary, but I made it. But it was a really good example of, you know, I'm really proud to have made it. But looking back, one of the things I learned in my MBA was, you know, all those case studies of when someone becomes so laser focused on finishing something that you don't necessarily see the periphery of what's happening and what the dangers are. And I'd absolutely lost sight of all of the dangers. And I look back on it now and think, I'm glad I did it, but I would never do it again. and I would counsel anyone else not to do it again. It was
You would tell people not to do it. Don't do it.
Not the way I went. I've had a couple of people contact me saying, oh, I see you've opened up a new route through the Pacific. And it's like, don't do it. You know, when I landed on that island in the uninhabited island, and I stopped and I got out of the plane, all of a sudden I thought, even if I had a flat tire, I'd need to be rescued now. I'd actually pushed it too far. So, and as it turned out, I was delayed taking off. Japan wouldn't give me permission to take off for 3 hours, which meant I had to take off in the dark, on an island with no power. So, I had to make my own landing lights on the runway. I had to leave an LED torch. I put LED torches down the length of the runway just so I could see to take off. So it was marginal.
Oh, look, I could talk to you all day about this, but we have to end now. I'm sorry,
okay.
Michael.
Oh, well, look, thanks. Thanks for having me on. And look, there's a book coming out now and the film's showing on Qantas.
Not to mention the Sun Cinemas.
And at the Sun Cinema. But if you flip channels after you've listened to Alan's podcast in the documentary section, the film's showing. So enjoy it.
That's great. All right. That was Michael Smith. He's the owner of the Sun Cinemas and the author of Voyage of the Southern Sun, an amazing solo journey around the world in a very small plane. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Al.